welcome to our podcast listeners. My name is John Somerville, Head of Financial Services at the London Institute of Banking and Finance, and I'm welcoming today Nicola Barker from St. James's Place. How are you, Nicola?
Oh, I'm good. Good to be here.
Yeah, look, and it is, I mean, we're recording on a Friday afternoon, so what better way to end a week than, a nice little podcast and lots to talk about, obviously, as always. Also, David Owen from the Open Work Partnership. How are you, David?
I'm very well. Thank you, John.
Yes. Now, you've warned us already. You've been media training this afternoon. Or not this afternoon, but this week. What's the biggest thing you learned about the media this week?
Where do you start? I'm just thinking about Paul Leon here. He thought, he's got a pause there. I better cut that out. It's like about anything, really. It's about being prepared, and it's about going in with three key messages, about having a story for each message. It's about having data examples for each message and not using percentages because people only get fractions. And then also having some catchy headlines. So we all remember Justin Urquhart Stewart, who was an absolute genius of this. But of course, now we have to be a little bit careful because we can't be too racy. So in your preparation, you've got to be catchy, but not racy. So how about that?
Catchy but not racy. That's a big lesson learned for our podcast, I'd say. Definitely, I don't think we can ever be accused of being racy, though. I think
not on a Friday afternoon. No.
Didn't we have the people from the Mortgage Podcast accusing us of being the Radio One of podcasts?
I think they did, actually. We'll be having a word with Gordon about that as well, who runs our mortgage podcast. He does work for me and he's limiting his career aspirations, if you ask me. So I'll have a word with him about that. Yeah. Yes, especially with Ken Bruce moving on from Radio 2 today as well.
It's a tragedy. Especially they're replacing him with. He's probably the best broadcaster on the radio.
100%. Well, it's Radio 2's loss is greatest hits, Radio's gain, I have to say. So at least you still get to listen to him, which is great.
And Simon Mayo. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he's gone to greatest hits radio and Simon Mayo is on that. So you've got, you now have Ken Bruce in the morning and then Drive Time, you've got Simon Mayo still with his confessions and everything.
Oh really? See,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Brilliant. Great radio station. Sorry.
This is far more important
than financial planning. So hold on. So this is, I've got a problem now because Sarah Cox, I think, is amazing. Next to Ken Bruce, Sarah Cox. Mm.
Yeah. So you've got, this is the rival now, you see. So,
you've got a Drive Time conflict.
Too, haven't they? You've definitely got a Drive Time conflict. But what you can do, because he does confessions at the same time every day, which is at 10 to 6 every day, you can just switch over to that, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. But Sarah Cox's humour, though, John. She's the female Peter Kay.
Yeah.
I never thought about it like that, but
I hadn't thought about it like that, but no. Now that you mention it, that's absolutely right. You know something, we ought to talk about something relatively financial planning-y, I think. So, Martin's not here today, unfortunately. So we will catch up with Martin at the next podcast, obviously. We wish you well, Martin, obviously. We'll hear a little bit more about updates from you, I'm sure, in the coming weeks. A couple of things we want to talk about. So Dave said already preparation. So our 5-minute preparation before the podcast really sounds like we planned this, doesn't it? We're going to talk about the consultation paper 22/24, which is broadening access for financial advice for mainstream investments. So a lot of you may have heard about this and, I've written about it recently and there's various other people that are quite interested in this, mainly because it's been a little bit divisive, I think, but some view it as dumbing down advice, some view it as a brilliant way of plugging the advice gap that exists in the UK. Some people have said that openly that they really like the idea and would come out and use it, and others are saying quite clearly that they wouldn't. So there's a lot of discussion, a lot of debate going on around this. But I think that first of all, if you've not read the consultation paper, actually. Certainly at least read the summary, the first few pages. Well worth having a read just to get your head around it. But broadly speaking, obviously, we'll take you through a little bit of information about it. So I'll come to Nicola first, because obviously Nicola's more recently read the paper, I think, and you know, really just to give us all the, you know, a few bit of a flavour of the aspects that you've picked up from it, Nicola. What do you think? You know, from the paper, what are the main points that people can take away from?
So it's so interesting that it's come to this. So the synopsis is that people prefer face-to-face advice. And as we all know, there is a savings gap, or require, you know, getting access to advice is more difficult, allegedly, than what it was. And so in times of high inflation, the report focuses on people who have in excess of £10,000 savings in the bank would like to ideally think about investing some or all of it with a view to potential greater returns. But the downside is where to go for advice. And whilst we've got robo-advice options, people just like the acknowledgement of receiving a recommendation from a person. So somebody who's a, you know, financially accredited. And that's where it all stems from. So the idea being is that it would be a focus purely on investment and purely aimed at the stocks and shares ISA market. Mm. And that's kind of where it's being pitched pretty much.
Mm. Mm. Yep. So a maximum investment, £20,000, isn't it? And straight into a stocks and shares ISA. It's not gone into any detail about top-ups, and it's not gone into any sort of huge detail about ongoing advice and that sort of thing. Hence the reason the consultation paper is there for people to comment on. And certainly if you have views, it's well worth feeding that into the FCA. And I think that you're absolutely right. You know, the robo-advice side of it, as played through from the FCA, really, you know, their findings have been that it's limited. You know, it still has a place. I think some, you know, there is a generation of people that don't mind using that kind of technology, but they really want to be reassured. And we've always known that human interaction in the advice market has always been a really sort of big positive. Dave, obviously, you've had a glance at this particular paper as well yourself. What are your thoughts at the moment?
It's a tough one. I see what they're trying to do. You know, I'll give you an idea. So I was at a conference and there was a platform provider. So this is an advisory platform, investment platform provider. And they said they'd been recently bought over and they were ninth in the UK at the time, the platform. So they wanted to get into the top three. So I Googled, as you do, who are the top 10 investment platforms in the UK? And it was a load of names I didn't recognize. You realize what they are. There's advisory platforms, but there's also client platforms, John, where clients can go and invest directly. eToro and things like this. So when you look at it, you go, it depends which lens you look. So you go in as an advisory firm, as we know, 80% of any advisory firms or most advisory firms' revenue comes from ongoing clients. And there's 20% new business comes in. And the existing advisors would say, probably, you know, they don't have to go looking for business. There's too much paperwork doing stuff, for example, ISAs and stuff like that. Why do they have to do the paperwork? But there's, let's say, doesn't go on to open work, by the way, but Ways and Means Act, you can direct a lot of clients direct to the platform to self-serve themselves on ISAs. So I can see the stuff in the press where they've asked existing advisors, do they like this stuff? And they go, well, there's no real need for it. Really. I can't see the point, because they know the ways and means around the technology. So then you look away from that. You go, okay, what about mass market? Well, mass market, I can open, I can download most apps or go on most websites and do an ISA quite easily anyway. That makes you think, so who's this for? Who's it really for? And then, so I think you've got the answer to that. But do you get me? It's sort of interesting, but you go, oh, do I really?
Yeah.
All the things we've got coming at us, is this the biggest thing? It'd be lovely to get more people saving and stuff like that, but it's not very, I mean, the dreadful thing is it's too easy to invest in dodgy stuff at the moment, Dogecoin, for example, than it is the good stuff.
I think that's the important thing, isn't it? You know, that there's so many brilliant asset-backed investments that are available. And I think the great British public, the advice gap exists because they, you know, most of them have got smaller investments that, you know, aren't cost viable for them to seek advice from an IFA, but equally online information is not good, you know, because they're not financially educated enough. So the halfway house, and I think the FCA paper really does allude to this, is that high street bank, building society, mainstream kind of stuff, where people will go and see their banks and talk about their money on a more frequent basis, and to have that sort of streamlined advice process for those people, for those smaller investments, that's cost effective, that doesn't cost a huge amount of money to do, or if, you know, whatever that transaction level actually looks like. But equally, they can offer more services through that particular advisor. So as an example, that advisor could also advise on protection, because there's no qualification necessary for it. The paper is proposing that an equivalent of a financial services regulation, an ethics paper, and an investment paper are required as a minimum qualification standard for the streamlined advice process, which is probably about half of what you'd expect for the full level four diploma. So also, you know, I think they're trying to generate the future financial advisor. So somebody who's got halfway house, got part of the qualification, which will accredit into the full diploma. So that's, you know, a useful tool for future, growing future financial advisors. Also helps them develop the soft skills as well, which is always overlooked. But at the same time, it's treated with the same sort of seriousness as it, you know, when it comes to vulnerability, when it comes to risk and that sort of thing. So those advisors can cut their teeth on smaller investments where everything's covered, but they've got that. And of course, the trouble with that is developing somebody and the client bank around them is difficult for the regular IFA and not very cost effective. Whereas a larger network, a larger organization, probably got a better way into the market on this one. So you know, that's the way we're viewing it at LIBF. You know, I think, you know, from a positive point of view, I think this may have a place, but it's not for everybody, and I think that's coming across loud and clear. Dave and I have been talking recently about financial coaching as well, which is an interesting aspect of all of this, because again, this is slightly different, but along the same lines, really, effectively, you know, financial coaches. What are your views on financial coaches, Dave?
Oh, crikey. So, Nicola, I better bring you in on this, because I could talk for too long, so I'll just say something quickly. Personally, my thought is, if you're not chartered already, what have you been doing? And if you are chartered, what do you do next? Hmm. And you go, well, what do I do next? That's a good point. And then you go, well, the AI is catching up. Most of us at the moment are using ChatGPT for everything and sacking off marketing agencies because chat does it quicker, faster, and more accurately. And also doing your soft facts for suitability letters, but I probably shouldn't say that. But the other thing is what gains you the most value from the relationship with your clients? Because the AI is going to go name, ownership, tax wrapper, and account quite shortly. So a lot of the professionals, so you could be chartered, and a lot of the stuff you learned in chartered, a lot of that stuff can be done by, you know, machine learning. So where do clients truly experience value? And we know value is how we make people feel. They then experience, you know, they feel it. They feel they make a gain as a result of a product or service, whether that's financial or otherwise. So you go, well, what do we do with all that? So it's all the coaching we're doing. How much better can we get? And I think financial coaching for people with existing client banks, big client banks, is going to become, well, let's say wealthy client banks, is going to become more and more important, particularly when dealing across the generations. You know, that's my feeling. Mm. Otherwise, you know, the tech's going to overtake us.
Mm. Yeah, it's such an interesting point, like financial coaching. And I suppose everything is stemming from the point that you made, David, about value. What, you know, what do people value? And let's call it out, you know, in some respect, are you justifying what you're charging people for ongoing servicing, right? So, but I think, well, a couple of things. So the AI aspect, I agree with you. Things are, you know, taken over, and my organization, we are now very much automated compilation of suitability letters for, you know, at least ironically ISA business for new monies. And so, and it's coming. I mean, but it'll never deal with complex advice. Mm. But then if we sort of take that financial coaching aspect and apply it to, or through the lens of what we're talking about in terms of this consultation about effectively people just advising ISAs, right? Is there any coaching to that in the great scheme? That leaves its point on. So how do you price point that then? You know, if you've got Mr. Jones and you do, right thing for him is to do an ISA for 10K. Mm. What's next then? You know, and how do you price that? Because obviously, you know, it's this, it can't be expensive. So it's quite a conundrum. And I find it, and the words I was using earlier, everyone who's listening was, if we're just talking about this, I was quite surprised at the narrowness of the proposal that we're talking about. So I can absolutely see the pros of doing it. I can absolutely see that. But where I find a bit of a disconnect is in the sense of knowing the FCA as we do and their broad view, their holistic view, that they are being very narrow on this and just saying, so what, they're removing barriers to advice, fine. But the narrowness is, well, it's just ISA business. All their measure of success is how many people have money invested in ISAs as a result. Hmm. And there's nothing else. And that's where I almost, not worry, but John, you were talking about just before about the protection element.
Yeah.
You know, what about the wider needs for people? How does that, if I've got wider needs identified as a result of this exercise, where do I then go? Hmm. So it's all this thing that, you know, yeah, where's the coaching bit into it?
Yeah,
you know,
it's a really interesting point that, and interesting, I think that this is a problem that we face across many different advice angles as well, Nicola. And I think that, you know, so for instance, if you take the equity release advisor as a good example of this, so an equity release advisor is potentially releasing fluid assets away from a property, you know, from a house, may or may not, and depending on how well they do this, you know, there may be implications regarding state benefits, there may be implications regarding taxation, there may be implications regarding other income aspects that these individuals may have by releasing that money. And of course, all these things need to be explored. And if the advisor isn't an expert in all these things, so for instance, you know, is there an inheritance tax problem for those clients? What is the qualified advisor handover to somebody who has those skills and that knowledge? And it's the same here. So you, as you're quite rightly explaining, you know, if you've stopped at 20,000 ISA, but this client would really benefit from some pension planning, and getting their tax relief and making the very, very most of their allowances. So it's not that this is a good starting point, but how do you then say, right, okay, I have to hand off here, and how do you do that? What is the next step? And what, you know, if these organizations, any organization takes this on, and I think a few will, what is that robust process that makes sure that, okay, I've identified this, there's a red flag here and there's a red flag here, I need to then pass that off to somebody who's that much more qualified. And eventually I will be that person because I'm going through that training program. I'll be able to advise in the future, but not now. I need to understand what that is. Dave, you look like you're going to come in.
Yeah, it's right. I was just thinking about this. This is probably a bad analogy, so bear with me, listeners. But imagine, so financial services at the moment is a bit like this, or it was, let's say. So a client says, I would like a 6-inch thick, 1 pound in weight, jammy donut. And you go, that is great, we do jammy donuts. In fact, we don't do normal jammy donuts, we do the best research jammy donuts. And I'll tell you what, we'll underwrite your eating experience of that donut, right, so it comes out the other end well. And the client will say, that is fantastic, how much are you going to charge for this donut? We'll say, I'll tell you what, we will charge you 5% of the value, let's say, big number, 5% of the value of the donut. And then if you want to eat donuts regularly, we'll charge you an ongoing servicing fee to make sure you're experiencing your donuts. Unfortunately, and that's a bit like what it's like. Unfortunately, we don't do donuts. We do broccoli. We do broccoli, right? So what we see is people come to, and it's a bit more difficult, isn't it? Because it's not very exciting. Broccoli isn't very exciting. We can do stuff to it to make it a bit more exciting. So you really need somebody. So thinking that was a nutrition coach before, not a financial advisor. You need somebody to convince people that broccoli is a good idea. And then they ought to pay for the best broccoli, and then broccoli on an, or other veg on an, if you can get them, that's topical, isn't it? On an ongoing basis. Remember that? It's a great way of getting people to tell them five a day, isn't it? Telling them you can't buy it. Anyway, so, yeah. So you've got...
Now three a day, by the way. I think the government guidance.
Is it three a day? Oh, yeah, they've reduced it now, haven't they? And if you want eggs, flipping egg. But anyway, so you've got this now. So bloody McDonald's, the only thing you can get in proliferation. So anyway, so what you've got is... Other brands are available. So what you've got is you've got this sort of thing where it has to be sold. So it has to be sold.
Mm.
And that's the difficult... We've got... So they go, oh, there's not enough people selling it.
Mm.
So what we'll do is we'll make it really easy to buy broccoli. It's still flipping broccoli.
Mm.
And to get to Nicola's point, it's not a lot of broccoli either.
No.
Mm.
I think that's the problem. Well,
first of all, I've never heard RDR described in a food way before. This is new, listeners. So I must admit, after 10 years of RDR, this is quite something. It's a revelation. And then secondly, I'm suddenly feeling a craving for donuts, and I can't explain why. And what you do, is a jammy donut, not a ring donut, we're talking about here, aren't we?
It's a jam. That's a whole nother psychology experiment that I won't go into.
Fabulous. Oh God almighty, where'd you go from here? Right. Yeah. Okay. It's an interesting concept, really, because when you think about what excites customers, and I think it's, you know, when you think this bit through, and I've said this already, and actually in some of the feedback that I've given on this, is it's got to be contextualized to the client that you're talking to. Mm-hmm. So for instance, and what I mean by that is, if you are talking to a client who's extremely wealthy and sees his IFA regularly, blah, 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 you know, and that sort of thing, the proportionality of any gains and losses, the proportionality of any charges are directly related to the wealth of that individual, right? Okay, so because they can afford to pay it, and also they can afford to ride those waves of gains and losses and what have you. Now, if you're somebody who's just come into for the first time ever, you've got £20,000 to invest. It may be that blue collar worker retires, nice, comfortable pension, first lump sum they've come across, that sort of thing. Or redundancy payment in later life, which is happening more and more and more frequently, as we know, you know, we've seen a lot of these sorts of payments coming out. They go and see their advisor, and their advisor for the first time is explaining these kinds of things to them. And although we think, okay, it's quite narrow when you look at what the FCA are proposing, but actually for that person, it's not narrow. This is massive. It's all their world. Mm. You know, it's a huge proportion of their wealth. And of course, they can't find anybody to speak to other than somebody who's dealing with this mm-hmm. Streamlined advice process. And therefore, first and foremost, that advisor still needs to be trained in the art of the soft skills, take them through what, you know, what's important, why they should do that, but also understand every single risk aspect as well. So, you know, the capacity for loss, the fluctuations mm-hmm. of the market, all these sorts of things that they need to understand, and check in for vulnerability as well, because that person needs to be treated in no differently to this person that's extremely wealthy, because proportionately, if they experienced a 2% loss, that's a big loss in their world, regardless of whether you've got £1 million to invest or £20,000 to invest. Does that make sense? And I think it's mm-hmm. that proportionality that we need to think about here. So, from my point of view, if you've got an IFA that says, well, actually, I can't see it working. Yeah, okay. For your clients, it won't work. I agree with that. I can see where you're coming from. But if you are the 90% of people that can't afford to seek advice, and are looking for ways, and they don't like online robo-advice, that sort of thing, and want to talk to a person, then actually for a good chunk of those people, this is probably helpful. And yeah. I think that's what we've got, you know, everything has its place, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a long way to go on this, I think, you know, but what do you think about that? I mean, do you see what I'm saying about this? It's kind of, you know, that, think about that particular client scenario, which is more common in the UK than the top 10% of wealth. You know, there's far more people in those sorts of positions.
I listen, John, you know, when you put it like that, I couldn't agree with you more. I think you know, but also, or do we, well, it's almost like, are we just going, you know, back in circles whereby, you know, you reference like banks and building societies. And actually, you know, one of the organizations I used to work for used to provide a guided advice whereby they weren't given advice, but you would help somebody go through a, you know, a question and answer process. And then the output was, okay, this is appropriate for you. So, it, you know, that, but are we going back to that almost like what we tried to get away from, whereby, you know, not pigeonholing people, because I don't like using that word, but it's like, but we're pushing them down a certain route to gain advice. And actually that was the route at RDR that was the, you know, the downfall of the industry almost, you know, and sort of then push the whole aspect of entry points being whatever. Some, you know, because of the commerciality associated with it. So, you know, I'll be intrigued. I will be intrigued to see how good. I genuinely believe it's a good thing. And obviously, coming from my academy background and my passion for, you know, the future of advice and the future profession, I think it's brilliant. I think it's a great in, you know, a stepping stone. I just worry some, and I need to see the sort of the proposal and what it then looks like, because I just worry that thing, yeah, it just becomes almost like, not again, I hate using this phrase, but one trick pony to the detriment of other areas of vice.
Yeah.
And that's my only sort of real concern about that. Listen, you know, we'll see when the consultation's finalised, and we'll see what it actually looks like, you know.
Yeah, that phrase "one trick pony," I tell you, you just brought up, you know, the industry's been guilty of doing that for a long time in the past, haven't they? Where they've stuck to one sort of set of funds with profits, as an example, you know, in back in the good old days or bad old days, whichever way you look at it. I mean, it's making a resurgence now, obviously, you know, when you look at the way things are. Dave, you got another point on that?
Yeah, so just continuing my donuts and broccoli.
Oh, we're back to donuts.
We've got another piece of regulation, which obviously is the overarching piece of regulation for the whole of the industry and the profession, which of course is consumer duty. And you think about that word, consumer. So we all consume food, right? We all consume money. I think that's where it came from. I couldn't understand. I was talking to an ex-director of the FCA saying, where did that name come from? Because people, they're investors, they're savers, they're not consumers. You think about what they're doing. They're looking at it. I think they're getting a bit confused about they're regulated. They still have the same name as the Food Standards Agency. But it's a bit like, you know, so you've got people consume all this food. Now, some of us consume good food. Some of us consume bad food. And most of us consume something in the middle. And, of course, it's the way in which this, going back to the coaching, this is a behavior about money. Now, some people who can afford it and want it and need it will have some form of dietitian or nutritional coach that they will pay for. And that you think effectively in financial planning, ideally, what we should be doing is paying somebody to be our financial coach. And I think where we've gone slightly adrift, you think, within the profession, slightly, is it's all about, and I think I put this down to the industry, you know, trying to get us to distribute their products, all for good reason. A lot of it's about the product. A lot of it is about the product, and it is about trying to get people to, you know, to buy their product. And when there's less about the final outcome, to get to your point on equity release, you imagine this. Imagine that we weren't remunerated for financial products, or imagine we were remunerated directly by the client for financial coaching. If the client said, we need to, you know, I've seen an advert on the telly, John, and what we want to do is take some money out of our house, that big piggy bank, take the money out and go and spend it. What do you think? You think the conversation would be completely different? I would argue, if you were paid just for the coaching, because you'd probably say, okay, let's just take a step back a second. Ultimately, what are you trying to achieve here? Let's look at all the different avenues. Let's follow all these different paths we can take. It might be a brilliant idea. It might be a brilliant idea, but it's worthwhile just investigating it. So, for example, an option could be, what we could do is trade down to somewhere that's more affordable, lower heating bills, cheaper to maintain, more modern, still with your friends around you and stuff like that. For example, you might be able to do that. Still releases the cash, but you're not left with the same problem, a house you need to raise money for in the future, for example. And then people go, I've never thought about that. You know, how many people, for example, extend the house just before the children go to university and then hang on to the house once the children have gone to university, got married and moved on? Because what they want to do is, just in case they come back for the night, twice a year. You know, so we all make crazy decisions about money. And then as a result, what people try and do is repair that situation with a financial product that's thrown at them. And you can see what there is. There's need to get products easily out to people, because let's face it, God almighty, don't we love sending documents at people, you know? And ISA, it was something like 30 odd documents accounted for a client to take out an ISA. If we can make that simple, that's amazing.
Mm.
It's amazing, isn't it? But if we were to go, okay, let's make that really nice and simple. But also, let's just take a step back. What if we could just, there are people saying that's one thing, but what about that guidance? But I'm not sure you can scale that, even though it seems to be the most sensible thing to do.
Mm. I think it's an interesting point. I mean, certainly, you know, we do see, you know, huge, and there, you know, the majority of equity release advisors and the Equity Release Council do a fabulous job of making sure those standards that you've just described there, David, they're upheld, because they're very, very open about the fact that actually equity release is not the right solution for everybody, and that's a really important point, and I totally get that. But like you say, and it's the same for investment advisors. You know, if you were to take the fees out of the equation, would the solution remain the same? You know, and obviously that's a bit of a debate that we could roll on and on and on and on. You'd hope so, you know, obviously, you know, but the motivation, whole point of RDR was to take that commission motivation out of the equation, yeah. Wasn't it? You know, and that's what we're trying to do with the whole thing. So, you know, hopefully that balance is there. I mean, the interesting argument with that is with the downsizing, because that's a raging one. I've seen so many different aspects of the downsizing thing, because obviously if you downsize, you're right, lots of outgoing current costs go down, but the big thing they miss out on is the proportionate growth of the house as it goes forward, if that makes sense. So actually sometimes it outweighs the money that they take out, which is quite an interesting argument as well. So we've seen that in a number of occasions, but again, it's a balance, isn't it? And it's finding out what's the most important thing.
Yeah, and I think this is the difficulty, because you think if you do this what's called a light touch, it's very hard to make margin at that. And sure, think about, for example, if you're a big bank, you could scale it, because what you'll do, it will probably go on your own investment platform nominee, and it'll probably go in your own funds, and there's probably some margin there. And yes, you will do all your, you know, price of value and all that research to target market. Yes, you'll do that, and there'll be something there, and over the scale in which they've got, you'll probably get it. You think for everything else, you know, it's like we're 10 years since RDR, but you still only get paid if you do things,
yeah, rather than paid for the advice itself.
Exactly. And I think, you know, for example, I've been through the Institute, as you know, I've been through the Institute of Financial Wellbeing qualification. That was really good. And being able to do a financial planning meeting with somebody but not talk about money, that's really hard.
It's difficult.
That's really hard. And it's almost like you've got two opposing things. It's, let's do it really simple, let them buy loads of things, but there's no money in it. You've got the market to one side, which is all the great financial planners you've got who are doing stuff at scale, and they can make a margin because they've got clients with over £200,000 to invest or whatever, which is all great and it's fantastic and do amazing things for people with massive evidential value. And then you've got this other group that are coming along and saying the bar for, and I'm not sure I agree with this, but the bar for actually implementing advice is quite high, actually. So they're saying, I can do all the financial qualification, all the financial coaching without any qualifications. All I need is a coaching qualification. And then what I can do is direct people to the direct, you know, the do it online digital to implement their advice. Because where I add value is the cash flow modeler and stopping people making bad decisions and getting them to behave in the right way with the money, going back to my nutritionist dietitian. And then when they go to the supermarket, they just buy the right things. And that's where some people, and I think that's a massive danger, because what you're now doing is potentially it's incentivizing people to move out of a regulatory environment and go to a non-regulatory environment, and then go, well, the regulated firms will pick that up when they go onto their platforms and transact it. I think effectively we're in a really disruptive period, and it's going to be interesting to see how professional advisors navigate this.
I think one thing I will say, and you know, before we move on, actually, you know, when you look at this particular paper, and for those that are interested, the consultation finishes. And the policy statement will come out at the end of, it says in the spring 2023. So we'll see when they come out with it. But obviously the consultation is ongoing at the moment. I think that what I am seeing from the regulator is they are really trying to start moving things forward. Consumer duty, I think, is a really probably the biggest positive I've seen from the regulator in a number of years. And I think that this, you know, really will have a massively positive impact on the industry. I think there's a huge amount of good going from that. I think this follows on from that. I think that, you know, the essence of what they're trying to do, there's always going to be technical details that are going to have to be worked through and what have you. But doing nothing now is not the right thing to do. Doing nothing for the greater British public is just not on anymore. You know, accepting that there's a advice gap is not the right thing to move forward. And actually, you know, I think everybody's been trying to do something about that advice gap and look for niches and look for ways to do it. But actually having a wholesale sort of, you know, with an industry backing, try and get something, a movement going that helps, I think is a good thing, you know, over and above what we, you know, we could debate this all over. And I think everybody's in agreement with that. You know, I think it's the right thing to do to try and bridge it. And as usual, the industry will have some very, very wise words on this. So I'm very much looking forward to seeing what comes out of this consultation, because I think there's going to be some very interesting comments coming out.
And I think we both know there's a firm in Holborn, John. I think I think they've almost nailed this. You know, which mixing with the low cost coaching model, £300 a year, you think 25 quid a month, and then an implementation through AI. So you could do this sort of stuff. In fact, you could do more than this sort of stuff in a regulated, repeatable process that PI insurers would probably love. But you're giving people coaching and guidance. Because the thing I think, Nicola, I mean, you're the master's qualification person on this one. One thing we were talking about recently is the number of conversations between men with men that only involves a woman at the end, when the man's falling off his mortal coil and she then becomes a client. It goes on too much, doesn't it? And so it isn't just the advice gap. I think we've got an immediate gap beyond just the normal advice gap, which is the both sexes gap, which, you know, and then you get the family gap as well. This is all within our gift, really. Anyway, do you get me about, you know, not KYC, KYF, know your client, know your family. It's all that sort of stuff we could do now. And then people going, oh, I can't do a regular premium ISA or a regular premium pension because there's no money in it. Well, there is, because you're already charging the client a fee anyway. So blinking it, just do it pro bono, because these people are going to be clients in the future. It doesn't have to be that difficult.
No, absolutely. Right then, I think we'll move on to our next subject, which is to do with inheritance tax, actually, Nicola, isn't it? So we were talking before we came on air to record this around the diminishing number of people that are offering inheritance tax advice. And obviously the fact that revenues are increasing quite significantly to the government, and obviously the coffers are, you know, they're not complaining about it, obviously, for the right reasons, you know. But I mean, I think there was a study done recently that actually the proportion, it seems like inheritance tax funds an awful lot of things, but actually proportionately to the government's coffers, it really isn't a huge amount of money that goes in. But obviously the amount of money that's ripped away from families is massive. It's absolutely huge. So yeah, we were sort of chatting away about this just before, weren't we?
We were, and so it's that, where's the disconnect? Because, you know, can you just attribute it to the value of property, in the sense of, you know, revenue, the billions that the government are making in inheritance tax is increasing. We know that. Despite the fact that, you know, the threshold is, if you've got two full nil rate bands and full residence nil rate band is £1 million. Yet the revenues, the receipts are increasing. So does that then mean now we're in that juncture where whoever created this had the foresight to say, well, actually, we've got to that tipping point because we're not increasing the inheritance tax threshold. We haven't done for, you know, so long. But the prophecy has come true, meaning that people's asset or most valuable asset actually is bricks and mortar. And therefore, you know, we're on a, how do I say it? It's almost like we're on a win here because obviously if that's their main asset and that's where the value of their bricks and mortar is or the most are part of their estate, then it's no wonder should people pass away that the revenue is going up. So is that what we're experiencing just now? And from an inheritance tax liability conversation, I have to admit, you know, in my world, I have some conversation. I don't have as many conversations as I used to have about, you know, client situations and ways and means of actually reducing it. Obviously, we're at tax year end coming up. And as a matter of course, we always talk about, you know, making sure that you use the allowances. So whether it's your £3,000 personal exemption, multiple gifts, £250, whatever it might be, charity, make sure that you do use them. But the actual whole, right, I've got a client scenario here where they actually have a physical liability isn't as commonplace as it used to be. Having said that, I do still have plenty of conversations about, well, just because somebody has an inheritance tax liability, doesn't have an inheritance tax liability, doesn't mean to say that they don't want to pass on their wealth in the way it's intended, right? So you don't have to have a liability to do that and pass it on in a structured format. But going full circle to sort of your original point, it's that disconnect though. Where is the nation's wealth right now? And is it bricks and mortar?
Hmm. Dave, your views on inheritance tax at the moment?
Yeah, it's Nicola, obviously, Paul also did agree. It's also here's another one as well. In the world in which we live, and I'm not saying this is my view, by the way, but in the world in which we live, is it moral to avoid paying inheritance tax? Because we had a client recently got me think about this. So it's a client, £10 million, not your typical client, but £10 million. Mm. So straight away, you get a call, what's the best way to invest this money? So you think, oh, that's a nice one. Because I'm thinking tax wrappers, oh, crikey, new CGT rates, all that sort of stuff. Mm. That's another subject, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so they say, don't worry about tax. We believe it's ethical to pay tax. We think it's for the good of society that we pay tax. What we just want to know, we want to know that the money is invested in a way that has the greatest impact to try and combat climate change.
Well, yeah,
that is different, isn't it? Because we know what we have to do. And when we're investing, people have to take all their investment preferences into account and all that sort of stuff. So you think about that. So there are people who are paying inheritance tax through preference. And we've also got the situation, let's face it, that there's a lot of people when they die, we're all living longer now.
Mm.
When they die, their children are older. The children are well set up. I get the feeling sometimes people say, well, they can pay the inheritance tax. They've got enough money as it is.
Mm.
Do you get me? So I think it, and I know there's no one answer to all these things. Mm. It's the property, it's people's views, mm. it's all those sort of things. And you know, it's another thing is what drives me mad sometimes. We don't do enough whole of life, or remember, we used to call it the guaranteed estate plan. We don't do enough of that. That's quite a simple solution, really, if people start it, you know, early enough, as we know. Mm. Not all that's done. And you think, why isn't that done? Mm. It's a bit, is it the law of also the property, a lot of people's wealth also in the pension? So you can't, liquid assets, you can't do so much with. So therefore, when they die, if they haven't done anything about the inheritance tax or the property. So, Nicola, my question to you is, buy a farm, buy a woodland.
Well, I've got plenty to choose from, but like we were saying earlier, so for IHD purposes, for the calculation, that is, it's the actual wood value of the wood, not the value of the land. Okay, that's exempt. Remember that before you go out and buy woodlands. Okay, but do you know, it's but Dave, you know, you could go back to the sort of the whole coaching aspect of what you know, because if you've got somebody who is property rich and cash poor, right, let's just use that analogy. And then you've got the, you know, somebody who's not regulated or qualified, but could charge a fee and say, well, actually, your options are. It's the same sort of thing like the equity release and say, well, you could look to downsize your property, realize cash and look to plan something with your cash, or you could downsize the property and give excess cash to your family. You know, it's just I mean, I don't know how you would charge for that, and I don't know, but you know, there's, you know, but you could generically go through what your options are. But the whole aspect of inheritance tax is, I think it is subjective. You're right, Dave. You know, there are people who don't mind paying tax and feel, you know, it's the right thing to do. Or if you could control how it was spent, I think a lot more, or many more people would be, you know, on board with it. But the fact remains it isn't, right? So we just don't know where it goes into the black hole with all the CGT that's just cunningly being, you know, sort of, or will be gathered come 6th of April. But it's I just think it's an emotive subject. And that's the thing, you know, particularly when it's the family home and how attached people are to it. And if that's their only asset, then, you know, I don't have many conversations with people to say, but you can still plan with the family home. It just, like, for example, you can accept that you're going to pay tax. It just means that it gets paid when the house is sold, and you can pay on installments, for example, with interest, by the way. But, you know, so there are ways and means if that's your only option. But I don't know. I just think, you know, this whole conundrum of, so where's all these multi-billion pounds coming from? And is it just because the property market's gone up? I don't know, genuinely, because, you know, have people's net wealth gone up, as in liquid investable assets? I genuinely don't know. So
difficult, isn't it? And yeah. And interestingly, I think we all carry cash, obviously, in various accounts and what have you, and you forget about it, really. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, oh, hang on a minute, there's some interest going on my account all of a sudden, which wasn't there before. I mean, that hasn't happened for years. I'm thinking, all of a sudden I'm getting interest on my cash. I mean, what's that about? I mean, I had to look it up. What interest, what's that?
Those are dividend savings rates, dividend allowances, and all those sort of things now come back to frighten us all and our texture too. But here's an example for you, though. This is a little bit of a case study. So on my morning dog walks, there used to be the chap used to live in a lovely big house in my village. Let's call him Alan. And we come across Alan, and he's got his little dog, and our dogs say hello to each other. His dog tries to ignore my dog because she's mental. Anyway, so what we do, nothing like the owner. Anyway, so what we did is I was talking to Alan. I said, where are you living now, Alan? He said, oh, I've moved to a new estate just down the road. He's moved to another village. He said, because he'd made the decision. He said, I was looking. He says, neither of us are getting any older. The stairs might be a problem in the future. And he said the property was getting more expensive to look after. It was getting more expensive to heat. So we thought, we'll move somewhere modern. It doesn't cost a lot to heat. That hasn't got stairs. It's easy to maintain. And he's made that decision. Right. And this is going back to Nicola's coaching. This is going back to the coaching. And this is where I think we had massive value. Going back to your consumer duty point, John. Consumer duty says, you know, the client has to experience value.
Yeah.
Quite often the press will say people are paying more inheritance tax, or they're paying more CGT, or people aren't using these anymore, or, you know, business relief products aren't being used, you know, all this sort of stuff. But, you know, it's a bit like, so what people do, they put those in the newsletters and send them to clients and wonder why the clients don't read them. But what the clients want to know is, what's this money doing for me? How is it giving me meaning and purpose? And what we should be really having conversations with clients about how they can get meaning and purpose from the money. And then it might be, actually, that's a really good point. Why am I living in this house? What can I do with that extra money? And that's a completely different skill. And no doubt the LIBF will come out with a chartered financial coach qualification, and that will solve all our ills.
That would be lovely, wouldn't it? I tell you something that, because I'd spoken to Chris Budd a few times on the financial wellbeing thing, and you know, I read his stuff with interest about, actually, how does your money make you happy? And I think that's an interesting point to make, really, you know, and probably a good one to finish on. You know, if you could judge your wealth in happiness, you know, and it's often the case, a lot of people say, I'd rather be happy than rich any day of the week, right? Okay, and a lot of people like that, and you can kind of understand that, you know, because it rings true. And you should keep doing the things that make you happy. Now, if your money is giving you an absolute headache, what will happen is you just turn off from it, like you say. So a newsletter might come out. I am not interested. That can go in. It doesn't even go hit the filing cabinet. It hits the bin that looks like a filing cabinet, and it never comes out again. You know, because what's happening is then it's getting that advice across that says actually what we'll do here is help you make really happy decisions about what you want to do with your money, not decisions that are just going to make you scratch your head and debate and have to argue with your family and fall out with various others. And you know, as we know, there's nothing causes more fallouts with families than a death, and trying to disseminate an estate is just the most horrific time for a lot of families. And then it gets worse by the fact that people are trying to get hold of the money, and it's always a difficult time. So how do you make yourself happy? And I think that's a really good way of putting it, really, Dave. I think that sort of plays to your point about actually why if you accumulate that wealth, what are you going to do with it? What makes you really happy?
I've just had a thought, Nicola. So inheritance tax. I think I've got an inkling of how people could get caught out. Do you think about this? So, for example, my cousins have done this. They've got their property registered as a farm now. Mm-hmm. So you've got to live on the farm, 7 years before it be classed as before you get full relief. So you've got 7 years on the farm. So you've got that. But what you could do, you could run other businesses, as we know, from that farm. Mm-hmm. But they forget that those other businesses might not get the full rate of inheritance tax relief. Mm-hmm. And I can see people who, let's say, aren't mass market, but are the sorts of people that need professional financial planning by a chartered LIBF financial planner. I think those are the sorts of people I think get caught out.
It just goes to show sometimes you just can't outperform or beat the system. I suppose, you know, sometimes if they don't get you one way, they will get you another, and hence the reasons for either business property relief or agricultural relief, you know, they come with their caveats. But no, absolutely.
It's impossible to, you know, and really, you know, that's not what we're about anyway, is it? We're not trying to book the system. What we're trying to do is help people manage that system so they don't have to worry about it. I think that's the key to it, you know, and it does cause a lot of worry.
It's been Marie Conn again, isn't it? So, you know, Marie Conn, if you've seen her on Netflix, it's a great series. And apparently, if you brought yourself up to date on it, she's had a few children now and she can't comply. But my wife's really into this. And it's how you fold your clothes and your drawers. And it's the Japanese system. And what you do, you pick your clothes up and you go, does this give me happiness? And if it doesn't, you say, thank you very much for your service, and you recycle it. Do you get me? And it's like doing that with your direct debits, with your assets and everything, and saying, do these still give me happiness anymore? Are the things I'm doing give me happiness? Does this house still give me happiness? Does this lifestyle still give me happiness? And then what I need to do is do things that give me happiness. And I think that's the direction of how we add value.
Excellent.
Wow. How can the FCA regulate that then?
No, but I think that's a great place to sort of move. Yeah. I'm just going to ask one more question. Well, in that case, speaking of happiness, so what's going to make you happy this weekend, Nicola? What one thing are you going to do that's going to make you happy this weekend?
Well, I'm going looking at kitchens tomorrow. That will make me happy. Yes.
That's where your money's making you happy.
Yeah. So,
Dave, what's going to make you happy this weekend?
Well, I've got a big problem tomorrow, John. Big problem.
What?
Because there's the Race of the White Roads, the Strada Bianchi in Tuscany tomorrow, big Italian race. And, my favourite cyclist, Mathieu van der Poel, is racing it. It's epic, epic, epic. But at the same time, I've got to go and visit where I want to go and visit my wife's uncle, who's more or less like my father-in-law, brilliant bloke.
Yeah.
But he's 89. He had COVID recently, and it almost finished him off.
Nice.
And he's playing the okie cokie between care homes and hospital, and he's getting better. So we're popping to see Jack, and that will be fantastic because he's an amazing bloke. He's very, very inspiring, and that will be great. But, you know, somehow I'll have my iPhone on the GCN app with an eye on what's going on in Strada Bianchi.
I'll tell you what, I'm sure Jack won't mind you doing that. He knows you too well, I'm sure. So,
well, he's blind as well. So as long as you keep the volume down, he won't notice.
That's the way to do it, isn't it? Perfect. Oh, I don't know. Listen, guys, thank you so much again. Brilliant, brilliant podcast. Thank you so much. Hopefully everybody listening will get something out of that. And if anything, you've learned something about donuts related to RDR stay. I think without a shadow of a doubt is a revelation, I think. In fact, I think you should write a paper for LIBF there, Dave, on how that donut works and all that sort of thing. I think it's just incredible, really. You know, the correlate, you know, what density of sugar should you have on top of your donut, how much jam should be in there, and whether and that as you say, that eternal dilemma of ring donut or jam donut. I mean, you know, I think that debate could, I don't want to talk about broccoli though. We don't want a paper on broccoli, if that's all right. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. I hope you've really enjoyed this one. We'll be back next month with another interesting podcast. But in the meantime, just to remind everybody that the Mortgage Conference is on its way, 19th of April, Congress Centre, London, Great Russell Street. Is going to be a fabulous event. We've got speakers from the FCA, major banks. So we've got Esther Deister coming to speak for us. We've got David Gill from the FCA. We've got people from across the industry in the mortgage and equity release and protection world. L&G are our title sponsors for that. And it's going to be an absolutely amazing day. Go to our website, book your tickets as soon as you can. I mean, it's going to be a fantastic event. Other than that, a big farewell from me. Nicola and David, thank you again so much for your time this afternoon. Really enjoyed the pod. And we'll see you all again next month. Take care, everyone.